It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and happy First Amendment Friday. Glad to have you with me for a little honestly provocative talk, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. We proudly provide honestly provocative talk for Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and we always try to make it as fair and equal as we possibly can. Everybody's invited to the conversation. On First Amendment Fridays, every subject is fair game, and I always hold true, always have, almost 25 years of putting the naysayers first, which means if you think my arguments are full of beans, and a lot of people do in the Northwest, that's okay. I'm glad to have you make your argument if you've got the guts to actually make it. Come prepared with your best arguments, your best logic, maybe a few facts. Although, make sure the facts are actually facts and not opinions, and we'll be glad to put you on the show. Although, I welcome opinions as well. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. Haven't yet found a way to move it over to Getter, but we will be doing that as we are growing on Getter. We're there at Lars Larson, and you're welcome to join us there as well. Or you can vote at our website, LarsLarson.com. I want to start off with the Arizona election audit. And before you roll your eyes and groan, I want to tell you why. We have been waiting most of this year for the audit to be finished of the Arizona election, because an awful lot of us said there was something seriously wrong with the Arizona election. Of course, there were serious things wrong with Georgia and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan, but we figured if we can show all the problems in the Arizona audit, because it's being done by the state of Arizona, it's being done by some of the Republicans in the state of Arizona, and it did cost some money. But so did the Mueller investigation, and that came up largely dry for its original mandate of proving that Donald Trump was somehow linked to Vladimir Putin. Remember, that one came up dry, but this one did not. But I want to warn you about something, because I've been in the news business a long time, and there is a spin with this story that's going on right now. Let me give you an example. They have now finished the audit. They have released the not just recommendations, but most of the final results of the audit. And what does it show? It shows 50,000 illegal ballots were cast in Arizona. If you want a take home for this, because I know you're going to hear about it from your liberal friends, they're going to say Joe Biden beat Donald Trump in Arizona by 10,000 votes. And your response should be yes. And the audit found 50,000 illegal ballots. So if you win a race by 10,000 votes and an audit shows 50,000 illegal ballots, what should your conclusion be? Except that's not the headline you're going to hear. There were 50,000 illegal ballots, and I'll give you some of the details in just a moment, because they are fascinating. And for those of us here in the Pacific Northwest, they are especially telling, because Oregon and Washington both have had vote-by-mail for decades. I told you yesterday about a lawsuit that's been filed in a number of Washington state counties that says a lot of the votes are being counted by uncertified machines, and there are good reasons to believe that many of those votes are not real votes. They don't come from real voters. They come from people who live out of state. They come from people who voted twice and the rest of that. So in the Pacific Northwest, there is good reason to question what happened in Arizona, and is that same thing happening in vote-by-mail states like Oregon and Washington? But let me give you some of the details. First, the spin that's been put on it from Reuters. Trump-backed Arizona election review reaffirms Biden win, Texas launches audit. The Guardian, which is a big newspaper in the United Kingdom, says controversial Arizona audit shows Trump lost by even more. I think the additional votes were somewhere between 49 and 99 votes, depending on which news source you're looking at. Draft report from partisan Arizona review confirms Biden defeated Trump in Maricopa County last November. And you say, okay, that's it. It's over. Well, technically, it's been over since the vote was certified, and there is no mechanism to uncertify the vote. So if you wonder, well, Lars, why are you still talking about this then? I want to tell you what they found when they went through and audited. And the finding you're going to hear the most about, if you look at the conventional mainstream media, is they're going to say they recounted the ballots, and the count came up pretty much the same. And you say, well, then it's over, right? Let me give you this metaphor. If I handed you a stack of cash and I said, count that cash, and you counted, and it was 20s and 50s and 10s and 5s, and when you got all done, you said, Lars, there's $2,500 here. I'd say, okay, now I'm going to tell you that some of those bills are counterfeit. You say, oh, I didn't know that. I said, now count them again. You say, but you said some of them are counterfeit. I said, yes, but you don't know which ones are counterfeit. But count it again. You count it again, and you come up again with $2,500. You say, Lars, it's the same amount. I said, but what if you find out that some of those bills are actually counterfeit bills? In this case, counterfeit bills are fraudulent votes. And what do I mean by fraudulent votes? Well, 50,000 illegal ballots cast in an Arizona election in which Joe Biden won by just over 10,000 votes. So what do they find? I'm going to give you the details because I think you're not going to hear a lot of this from the mainstream media. Mailed-in ballots that had voted from a prior address. So people voted once, then they voted again from their new address. 23,344. Voters that may have voted in multiple counties. And what do I mean by that? They found more than 10,000 votes that were counted in Arizona that came from a voter with the same first name, the same middle name, the same last name, and the same birth year. Now, would that make you a bit suspicious? I mean, there are other people that I know of named Lars Larson. But how many people named Lars Christopher Larson with a specific birth date? Not as common. More ballots returned by the voter than were received. That was 9,000 votes. Official results do not match who voted. 3,432. Voters who moved out of state during the 29-day period prior to the election. That was 2,000 votes. Counties where they counted more votes than there were voters. That was about 800. Ballots returned but not in the final voted file. That was 500 ballots. When you total it all up, it totals up to more than 50,000 fraudulent votes, or at least potentially fraudulent votes. There were double scanned and double counted ballots, about 50 of them, not a huge number. There were ones where the date of registration changed prior to the election date. A couple of hundred of those. Voters with incomplete names. That's kind of convenient. Almost 400 of those. And mailed-in ballots received without a record of being sent. Almost 400 ballots where they got a ballot in, but they had never sent a ballot to that voter. But they confirmed that voter voted. Does that sound like the possibility of fraud to you? And thousands of examples where ballots just simply didn't have the documentation attached to them. My question to you is, even though this isn't going to change anything in the presidential election, according to the law, is it a good reason to take a hard look at vote by mail and be more than a little bit suspicious about whether or not we get a valid result from it? Coming up on this First Amendment Friday, your phone calls and emails, a nurse talks about her last days on the job after getting the vax mandate, and America's highest ranking tax cheat.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish wrapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
I have to say, it's so much fun to wake up on a First Amendment Friday morning and hear Major League tax cheat Joe Biden explaining how he wants to raise taxes on the rest of us so that, you know, everybody pays their fair share. I think you're going to hear that phrase more than once in the months ahead. I'll back up the statement about Joe being a tax cheat with some real evidence. Joe made a lot of dough between his VP job and the presidency. $13 million in 2017 and 2018, mostly from giving speeches. He apparently talks real pretty. But he only declared $800,000 as actual income. So how'd he do that? Let me explain. Joe talks a lot about making the rich pay their fair share and not allowing them to do all those tax cheats that we know they all do, right? The latest numbers from the Biden IRS show the top 1% of earners in America pay 41% of the entire federal tax bill. The top 10%, now that's households with incomes above $166,000. If you want to imagine that, in Portland or Seattle, that's a police lieutenant married to a teacher. That top 10% pays two-thirds of the entire federal tax bill. Half of the earners in America who get a W-2 paycheck pay no federal taxes at all. Does that give you the picture? So how did Joe make all those taxes go away? Especially since Joe and Jill are in about the top one-tenth of 1% in America. Well, Joe Biden, who wants everybody to pay their fair share, ran that income from speeches. You know, it didn't come to him. It came through an S corporation where Biden himself is the entire corporation, a one-man show. Estimates today show that he dodged about $500,000 in Medicare taxes. You know, the medical insurance for older folks who keeps them out of poverty, the one that's currently going broke in the next few years, the one that Joe says he'll save because he managed to avoid paying $500,000 himself. Now, what was that Joe was saying about making the rich pay their fair share? John Kohler writes in from Lakewood, Washington, Lars, it's gotten ridiculous and dangerous. In my opinion, Biden's attempt to deny monoclonal antibodies from red state political adversaries like Ron DeSantis in Florida amounts to germ warfare against those in America they view as enemies. It's getting dangerous to be a law-abiding American. Thank you very much, signed John Kohler. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you
ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
In this case, I have to spread the grill around a little bit. The news came out this week. The synthetic opioid fentanyl has now been implicated in a gigantic increase in overdoses in Oregon over the last few years. 460 unintentional opioid overdoses just last year. That's about double the number from 2019. And if you ask, well, what changed? I'll give you two major changes that I think apply right here. Number one, Oregon and Washington de facto legalized. That is, it isn't technically legal to use hard drugs, but they have decriminalized it to such an extent there's no criminal penalty anymore, and the cops aren't pursuing it anymore. De facto legalization of hard drugs. In Oregon, it was done by a citizen vote. The one in Washington was done through the courts. Item number two, open borders Joe clears the way for the Mexican cartels to get as much product across the border as they want. The grill goes to everyone responsible for making those changes. Today's best email, but you can always send more on a First Amendment Friday to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest. Now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Online at RiverCityUSA.com/careers. Philip writes in from Ridgefield. Lars, after listening to your broadcast the other day about stopping the use of natural gas, gas-powered vehicles, coal-generated electric plants, I liken what is happening today would be similar if it had happened in the late 1800s. I can't imagine anybody going along with the suggestion that we simply kill all the horses because of the manure in the streets they cause and expect the recently invented automobile was going to fix all of that. Our solar, wind, and battery technology is still in its infancy, like the automobile at the turn of the 20th century. It just baffles me that anybody is going along with discontinuing gas, oil, natural gas, wood, nuclear, and hydroelectric power. We've gone mad. Thanks, and keep slugging away. Signed, Philip. Now, at this point, I want to welcome a young lady to the show who wrote to me. She is much like some of the other nurses that have reached out over the last several weeks saying, I'm about to be fired by the healthcare institution I work for, but it's going to put that institution in bad trouble. Michelle McConnell joins me now. Michelle, welcome to the program, and tell me why you wrote to me and what you described to me. I want my audience to hear it.
Hi, Lars. Thanks for having me. I will be fired. My last day of work is September 30th, and then I'll be terminated on October 18th because of a vaccine mandate. My unit is experiencing the largest loss of nursing staff. We were originally designated as the COVID unit over, you know, not quite 2 years ago, and we're losing the most nurses from this mandate.
And you've been at Legacy Health for 8 years, right?
I have. I've been there for 8 years, yes.
And you're losing a lot of nurses, like we've heard all these other institutions are. What do you think this is going to do to patients?
It's going to increase the risk of a sentinel event, which is when a preventable medical error occurs and causes death to a patient. It also impairs our ability to provide evidence-based care. And so the care of patients is affected.
You gave me the example that in what's called the progressive care unit, usually it's 4 patients for every nurse, right?
Yeah.
And now it's going to go from 4 patients to 5, a 25% increase in the number of patients every nurse has to take care of?
Yep. As we have moved closer to the deadline to get of the mandate, staffing is now moving forward with knowing how many people are leaving, and they're increasing our nurse-to-patient ratio. In addition to that, nurses are going to have to be taking over respiratory therapy, things that normally would be handled by respiratory therapy because of their loss of staff. We're going to have to be doing more blood draws, so we're acting as a phlebotomist. We may have to do some more housekeeping. All the ancillary staff and other staff that support our role to take care of patients gets put onto nurses.
And you're planning a protest next week. Tell me about that.
We are, yes. It's going to be at Legacy Salmon Creek Medical Center on October 1st from noon to 2. We would like the community and anybody who wants to come and support us to come and show up at the sign outside of the hospital that says, heroes work here.
How does that feel like to be a hero all of last year and a zero as of September 30th?
It's just a marketing campaign at this point. It has no weight to the saying at all.
Michelle, you be well, and thank you very much for writing to me. Coming up in a moment, what about voter suppression and that Arizona audit and the popular notion in the mainstream media that the Arizona audit actually proves no problems in our elections? It's next on First Amendment Friday. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I've told you that the Arizona election audit is now being trumpeted around the country, perhaps even around the world in other newspapers that cover elections in the United States, as proof positive that the election of November 3rd, 2020 was as clean as a hound's tooth and as pure as the driven snow. Well, I thought I'd go to a guy who actually knows elections and election law, and he knows them well, Hans von Spakovsky, senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Hans, welcome back to the program. And I've told my audience that on one hand, they're saying, gee, when we recounted the ballots, the count came up pretty much the same it came up after November 3rd. And I said, if you're counting a stack of counterfeit bills or a mix of counterfeit and real bills, and you count, the number is always going to come up the same. But it doesn't mean that much money is in that pile if you know that some of the bills, or in this case, ballots, are counterfeit. What's your take on the Arizona election audit and what we found out today?
Well, that's exactly right. And keep in mind that they are noting a lot of other problems, you know, more duplicate ballots than the ballots that were promised. For folks who don't know what that means, if a paper ballot has been damaged so it won't go through the computer scanner so it can be counted, election officials are supposed to create a duplicate ballot and void out the other one. But here they say, well, there were actually more duplicate ballots than can be accounted for, plus other problems. You know, they say they found individuals who were registered in more than one county and voted twice in the election. All of that needs to be investigated. You know, critics of the audit, Lars, are talking as if, oh, this is it. This is the end of it. Biden won, and so there's no more to it. No. The results of this audit ought to be the beginning of a thorough investigation by the election officials in Maricopa County to actually go through and investigate all the problems noted in the audit to find out, are they correct? Why did they happen? how can this be fixed so it doesn't happen again? And was there any intentional misconduct that needs to be prosecuted?
Yeah, because when I look at these numbers, these aren't small numbers. When they say voters and they say potential voters, they're going to go through and they're going to check these more. 10,000 of them who appear to have voted in two different places in the same election, two different counties. Right. And you say, well, there were only 10,000 votes between Trump and Biden. So that was the margin of error. And 23,000 mail-in ballots that had voted from a prior address and then voted again. So right there, you've got 33,000 votes that might well be fraudulent in an election that was decided by less than 11,000.
Yeah, and like I said, what has to happen is election officials and, frankly, law enforcement officials need to investigate every single one of those voters to find out, for example, is this really the same person? You know, is this the same person? Did they vote twice? To basically verify what the audit has found. And we really won't know the final answer to any of this about the Arizona election until and unless they actually do that. And look, they might come back and say, well, the audit is wrong of the 10,000 people that they claim, were registered in two different counties. We checked. They're actually different individuals with the same name. But on the other hand, they may come back and say, well, we checked this and 5,000 of these individuals, in fact, were the same person. And they did vote twice. But they've got to investigate that.
Well, because I pointed out to people these potential duplicate voters, according to the audit, says they have the same first name, the same middle name, the same last name, and the same, in most cases, birth year. So if somebody was trying to cast two votes in an election that they cared a lot about, and they said, well, you know, I've got a ballot, say, at college, where I'm going to college, and I've got a ballot at home, except, you know, I changed the birthday just a little bit. It does raise your suspicions how many people in a given state have the same first, middle, and last name and the same year of birth. It doesn't seem very likely, does it?
Well, what I would tell you is there's actually a remarkable number of people in this country who have the same names and even the same birthday and year. But we're not going to know, again, unless election officials take this information and investigate it. And that includes, by the way, supplementing the voter registration information they have on each of these individuals to use the more unique identifier information that they're probably inside the voter registration files that these auditors didn't have access to.
Okay, and there are a couple of thousand votes of people who apparently cast a ballot, but then they knew they were moving out of state. Now, I don't know what the election laws are for Arizona, but they're different in different states. But if you get a ballot 3 weeks out from the election, but you know you're moving 2 weeks from now, so you're going to be gone a week before the election is held, you can't legally cast a ballot, or can you?
That's going to depend on Arizona law, but I would suspect that in the same way you're not supposed to count the ballot of somebody who's dead on election day.
Which does happen.
That's probably the same rule that applies to this.
Okay, let's talk about what's going on Capitol Hill. I've summarized this as the Constitution says states run elections, and the federal government, for the most part, stays out other than things that might deliberately try to discourage people because of race, gender, national origin, things like that. Where does that effort stand, and what is it that the Democrats are going to get away? Are they going to get the federal government to seize control of the elections from states, and what is that going to do to voting?
Well, that's what they're trying to do, and in fact, on Wednesday, I was a witness, and I testified in front of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, Subcommittee on the Constitution, and we were there to discuss another bill that's been put forward by Democrats. It actually has already passed the U.S. House. It's called H.R. 4. And it's a long bill, but in essence, it would give federal bureaucrats inside Department of Justice, if you can believe this, veto authority over election law changes made by state legislatures. So, for example, if your state decides that it would be a really good idea to require an ID to vote, and they pass a law saying that, That law would not be and could not be effective until the state first submits it to the U.S. Justice Department, and the Justice Department says it's okay. So they in essence, I mean, the idea of that federal bureaucrats, unelected bureaucrats, would have veto authority over what state legislatures do is just unbelievable. It's unconstitutional. It's unprecedented. But Lars, the point of this hearing yesterday was, look, I was there, but they had these three witnesses there in support of the bill who the vision of America they have is like they're in a fantasy land. They were talking as if it was 1875. Reconstruction has ended, and there's massive, massive voting discrimination going on across the country, which is complete falderal. I mean, it's just not true. But that was the picture these witnesses were presenting.
I'm trying to imagine how voters are going to react to this when they say, the Constitution gives my state the right to set the laws. And we as citizens send representatives to the state capitol, and we tell them what we want the election laws to be. And they can make them tough or easy or whatever. And now we have to go hat in hand to some bureaucrat whose name we don't know, who was never elected, and ask that bureaucrat, can we pretty please change the laws of our elections in our state? That's Hans von Spakovsky, who's a senior legal fellow and a national expert when it comes to election law. Glad to be with you and always glad to get your calls. It's First Amendment Friday, 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And this is First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network. Always glad to be with you. And I'll get to your phone calls. I want to mention our Twitter poll. Have Northwest governors created their own healthcare crisis by forcing out doctors and nurses with vaccine mandates? You heard from one nurse earlier today, earlier this hour. Our Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. Can't get it on Getter yet. They don't have the technology, but we've asked them for it. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. I want to speak to Angie for just a moment. Angie, your husband wrote to me and said, you, and I don't know you and I don't know your husband, but he said you had a rather disturbing experience at the Winco store the other night. You live in Central Oregon. What happened?
Well, it was the day before yesterday. I was shopping at Winco. I don't do that a lot because we live about an hour and half or hour away. But as I was shopping, I heard an announcement, and I kind of, you know, how it's just in the back of your mind. And it said something to the effect, it said a woman's name, first and last name, and then she announced that this person, Jane Smith, will say, Jane Smith has just entered our store and she is not wearing a mask. If you would please return to the customer service area, we can provide you with a mask. Thank you very much, kind of. And I didn't really pay attention, didn't register until they did it a couple of more times to different people, using their first and last name, calling them out for not wearing a mask.
So, what'd you make of that?
I am a very busy person, and I was processing it. The last time they did it, I was in the checkout line, and I was looking over at the self-checkout, and there was a woman standing there, kind of the customer service area.
Yeah.
And she was a tall, dark-headed, younger woman. And after she made the announcement about the final person that I heard not wearing a mask, people started laughing and clapping. Like, it was just awesome to be shaming these people that were walking into Winco to shop. I was totally floored.
Angie, I did my due diligence. I reached out to Winco. They sent me off to corporate, which is, I think, outside the region. It may be in the region. And they wrote back and said, no, flat denial. We don't do anything like that at our stores. So I'm kind of left with your story, and you're willing to tell it to my audience. And then I'm left with Winco's flat denial. Did you ask anybody else at the store what was going on?
Yes, I actually phoned the store on my way to work this morning, and I talked to a manager named Matt, who was really nice. He did not work the day before yesterday, so in his defense, he probably could say he had no knowledge of it. But when I told him exactly what happened, and I asked him, have you heard of this? Has anybody else mentioned it? And he said, well, I've heard murmurs. I said, they're not murmurs. This really, really happened. And, you know, it did. It took me a while to really process the gravity. Had they announced my name? Because sometimes I space it out, you know, and I just forget to put my mask on. Had they done that to me, I probably would have went to my attorney. I mean, I would have, once the embarrassment wore off, I would probably be very, very angry.
You know, Angie, the reason this one kind of had the ring of truth to me, because I always have to evaluate that. You know, I mean, people want me to say all kinds of things on the air, but because we've seen a ramping up of public shaming, saying we're going to fire you if you're a nurse or a doctor or, you know, a cop or a paramedic or a firefighter. Not only are we going to fire you, we're going to deny you unemployment. And we're going to make sure you can't work in the industry in this region. You know, that this stuff from the president on down on one side, for the most part, has been, we are going to shame you. We're going to make your life miserable. And it just doesn't seem to be appropriate. Not in America.
I wish I would have recorded it, but I got to tell you, it came at me from blindside. It didn't even occur to me fast enough to realize that anybody would do that. And I told Matt on the phone, if I'm ever in the store and you do that again, I will never shop at Winco again. I'm not sure I will now.
That's pretty disturbing. And they should, if they're going, I've always said, if somebody's going to do something bold, if I want to come on the air and say, like I did earlier today, that Joe Biden's a tax cheat, I think my audience expects me to, okay, Lars, back it up. If you're going to say that, back it up.
Sure.
And if you're not ready to back it up, keep your damn yap shut. And I just, so when I heard this, I thought I got to give this some public attention. And again, I went to Winco and corporate said, well, we don't do anything like that. I'd be curious. I'd love to hear from somebody at the store you went to say, yeah, we were doing that for a while or whatever. But you say this just happened a couple of days ago. Angie, I very much appreciate anything else you wanted to say.
Just real quick, I told Matt that I would have no problem coming into the store and identifying the woman that was on the mic making those announcements because I looked at her. I watched her make the announcements. So, I mean, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people in the store. So it's not, it couldn't be denied.
And you also wonder, how did they know exactly which name the person was and what technology might have been behind that? It's First Amendment Friday. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. 866-HEY-LARS. It is the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm going to get to your phone calls and emails. We've even got a naysayer on hold, and that's what First Amendment Friday is all about, serving the Pacific Northwest with honestly provocative talk radio. Our Twitter poll today, have Northwest governors created their own healthcare crisis by forcing out doctors and nurses and paramedics with these vaccine mandates? I'd say yes to that. Today's Twitter poll brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. And you can join the best conversation in talk journalism anytime you like. And as I say, naysayers go to the head of the line. I wanted to get John Lee on for just a moment because he's been dogged about pursuing some of the biggest, most expensive, most consequential public works projects that are going on in the Northwest. And one of those is the connection between Oregon and Washington across a bridge that was supposed to have been replaced more than a decade ago. That project has been an out-of-control monster, in my point of view. Years ago, they said it was going to cost $4 billion to build the bridge. And then we realized that when you look closely at it, it was a light rail project with a little bit of bridge attached and not much of one. And now they're taking a second swing at it, the two states, to try to fix this choke point that is probably the worst choke point between Canada and Mexico along the Interstate 5 corridor that goes up and down the West Coast. So, John, welcome back to the program. What can you tell my audience you've learned about what it is they're going to try and pitch to us? How much is it going to cost? And are we getting another light rail project with nothing much of a bridge attached?
Well, Lars, you nailed it all, as usual. The rejected CRC was going to be $3.5 billion and offer a one-minute improvement in the morning southbound commute for people. And now they're talking between $3 and $5 billion. And just this past week, the project administrator was asked a very direct question by Oregon Senator Lou Frederick. Frederick said, "How much time will people save?" And that is exactly what the average citizen wants to know, because they're stuck in traffic roughly at 12 hours a day. And Johnson punted and said, "Well, we really don't know. We are only going to put three through lanes on the new bridge, which is exactly what it's replacing. So clearly, if you replace a congested three-lane bridge with three new lanes, you're not going to solve traffic congestion problems, let alone spending $3 to $5 billion for it."
And they really have no idea how they're going to pay for that, do they? Do they have any idea where the money's going to come from?
Well, they're hoping Uncle Sugar, in terms of President Biden and Congress, are going to tee up a bunch of quote-unquote free money. But the answer is no. Johnson has told the legislators in the community, "You can expect tolls," which was part of the CRC project, but in reality, they don't know. Both states have been told to expect to write a check for $1 billion or more, plus tolling and hopefully some level of federal money that nobody is willing to specify.
You know, John, there's another issue that you brought up that I hadn't really thought of, although it reminded me of a story years ago when they were replacing a 911 dispatch center. And the city, in that case, the city of Portland, said, "Let's build it to the old earthquake standards. The new ones are about to kick in." And they deliberately, you know, diminished the earthquake preparedness. You pointed out they're building this to a 500-year standard rather than build it to the ultimate earthquake that could hit the bridge. Is that the case?
Yes, that was an amazing revelation during the meeting where one of their lead managers briefed that he responded to an email question I asked and said they would be building it to a 500-year medium-level earthquake standard, as opposed to normal plans call for a 1,000-year standard. The Columbia River crossing was allegedly tasked with providing a 2,500-year standard. And, of course, that tees up the whole reason, allegedly, for building this project. As the governor of Washington, Jay Inslee, said, is this could come down in even the smallest earthquake. Oh, come on. You know, talk about political hyperbole. And the reality is the Cascadia subduction zone happens roughly every 1,000 years. And it's been 320 years since the last time it shook. And most of the experts say, realistically, there's a 10 to 14% chance of that level, a magnitude 9.0 earthquake, happening in the next 50 years. And so that means you're looking at an 86 to 90% chance it's not going to happen in 50 years. But if you're going to spend this kind of money, by golly, it ought to be pretty sound, but that's not what they're looking at. Which again gets us to the point, why are they building this?
Well, and
you,
John,
and I know they want a light rail project in search of a bridge.
Right, which, by the way, the last time it was voted on in Oregon, it was voted down. The last time it was voted on in Clark County in any way, it was voted down. The people have said, no, we don't want it. And the elites have said, we're going to do it anyway. The reason I raised the earthquake question, John, and I'm having to reach back, but this was quite a while ago. They rebuilt a 911 center about 20 years ago. And somebody called me who was an engineer and said, hey, they're building it to the old standard. The new standard kicks in a few months. And I said, well, then why are they building it to the old standard instead of saying, well, at least meet the new standard? And he said, there's no good reason. I said, how much more would it cost to build it for a 9 earthquake. And he said about 5 or 6% more. Now, John, if somebody's going to build, let's say, $100 million project, and it's going to cost $5 million more if you build it to the tougher earthquake standard. And the same engineer pointed out to me that I think it was Albertsons was building a big data processing center, you know, for all their stores, and that they had built theirs to thoroughly withstand a 9. And why? Because after the earthquake, they want to be back in business. So they built a building for their data center to say, we're going to protect that stuff so that, you know, we're not back in business 2 years later. You know, all the cash registers go down, all the, you know, the other infrastructure for ordering and everything else. And it costs them a tiny fraction to build it more. This is a choice where if they make the choice to say build 1,000-year, 2,000-year, or 500-year, I suspect, and I'd love to know the number, somebody has to know the number, is it going to cost maybe 5% more? If you're going to spend $3 billion on something, would you really stint on spending 5% more to make sure that your new $3 billion or $5 billion bridge isn't knocked down by an earthquake that just happens to go outside the expectations?
You're absolutely right. Let me tee up one other amazing fact.
Real quick.
I did some digging. ODOT estimates it needs to spend $5.1 billion to do seismic upgrades or replace nearly 1,000 bridges throughout the entire state on those state-owned highways. Why would anybody spend $5 billion on one interstate bridge when you could fix the entire state's bridges for that $5 billion?
That's a great way to put it. That's John Lee. I'll get to naysayers and your phone calls coming up next. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and we always go to naysayers first, and Murphy has been very patient. So to a patient naysayer, Murphy, welcome. And what do you and I disagree about on a First Amendment Friday like this?
Thank you, Lars. Yeah, there's a couple things that we disagree about, but most of the stuff we do agree on. I just want to say, I want to open up with a question. What eradicated polio?
Vaccine.
Okay. And in the past, you have called the current shot that everybody's getting for COVID-19 what?
A vaccine. Although it's really not, if you think about it, it's more of a symptom suppressor, even by the account. But you're still not getting to what we disagree about, and it is First Amendment Friday. Murphy, I'll give you a little latitude, but I do want to get some other calls. What do we disagree about?
Well, I think you just explained it right there, because it's not a vaccine. A vaccine eradicates, and the current shot going around is not a vaccine.
Okay, you and I agree on that. Then you weren't a naysayer after all, right?
Well, you still refer to it as a vaccine.
I know, but Murphy, hold on a second. When we get into language on this show, there are people who say, they'll call in and say, a guy had a gun with 3 clips. And what he meant was magazines. And if we spend all our time talking about the words, if I stop using the word vaccine and say the COVID symptom suppressor instead, people are going to say, well, what do you mean? We use words so that we know what we're talking about. If I say book, you know, then people know what I'm talking about, a book. If I say a collection of pages between leather covers, and they go, what is he talking about? It doesn't help the conversation just to get tied up in language, does it?
It's colloquialism.
No, it's not a colloquialism. They're calling it, they've been calling it a vaccine. I've made the argument that it's a symptom suppressor multiple times because it doesn't actually vaccinate in the sense that most people think of it. Although folks say, well, what about the flu shot? The flu shot doesn't necessarily mean you won't get it. Well, the flu shot is supposed to mean you won't get it for the 4 or 5 flu strains that they put in each shot. But every year there are probably many times that number of flu strains that are out there. But Murphy, thanks a lot. Not the greatest naysayer in the world. Let's go to Andrew. Andrew, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, it's Lars. Thanks for having me on. So the first thing I wanted to talk to you about, I sent in an email yesterday that I don't know if you saw, but
Andrew, the audience hasn't seen it. Let's just get to what you want to say.
Yes.
Okay. That way, if you refer to emails that I haven't seen and the audience hasn't seen, then we're all in the dark, except you.
Yes.
Okay.
So I was about to continue on to that. So what it is regarding is your view on school choice.
Okay.
And what I was wanting to regard to you was that Enterprise, I mean, not Enterprise, Oregon in the stat, in the Oregon Reserve Statute does have a semi-school choice system. So it's not a full school choice what we have. It's called interdistrict transfer, and you're allowed to transfer to a different school within an area, geographic region.
That's not school choice.
Well,
no, it's not. It's not. Do you buy food? Do you eat food?
So what?
Hold on. Okay, so if somebody says, you say, I'm not happy with Fred Meyer. I don't like their service. I mean, Fred Meyer is actually a decent store. And they say, okay, you can shop at any other Fred Meyer you want to go to. Is that choice? Or is real choice saying, if I'm not happy with Fred Meyer, I go to Safeway. If I'm not happy with Safeway, I go to Winco. Or I go to Whole Foods. Or I go to, you know, Nature's or whatever. That's choice. Saying, if you don't like this government school, you can go to another government school. You think that's a choice?
What? I am specifically, I'm not saying it's a full choice.
It's no choice. One government school or another failing government school is failure.
So what I have specifically understanding is my geographic region, which is Willow County. We have three schools for 8,000 kids.
You have three government schools. How many private schools are there?
We have one public charter and two full public.
Okay. Do you have any private schools? Do you have any parochial schools? Do you have any?
We have one private Christian school.
And you left them out for some reason. Why did you do that?
Well, I don't bring it up because it's a not that I have anything against it. I don't know enough about that school.
Okay. But the point is, you see the choice as government school, or government school. To those of us who actually look at the world and say choice means you can take your kid for education anywhere you want to go. That's school choice. Having your choice of this government school or that government school when the government schools as a group fail the students miserably is no choice. Is it?
And I do understand that point. What I am partly working on, I'm working on doing a bill change to part of education's law to change that to a full school choice system.
Good. Who's going to introduce it?
What I am currently arguing is we have some of the backbone already laid in the system, so it's not a very hard way to change it to a full school choice.
But are you talking about real choice where you can go anywhere you want with your kids?
I am.
Okay, so the dollars would follow the child from a government school to a private charter to a public charter to a parochial school to a private school or any of them. That's what you're proposing?
Yes.
Okay,
that's what I am looking at trying to change because we already have the backbone laid with how our legal wording is to do that. It is just that we only basically have it outlined to work within public schools.
Exactly. And now we need to get it to real choice, which is not government, one kind of government operation or another. Let's go to Jeff. Hey, Jeff, welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well.
So I'm calling on behalf of truck drivers. So I want to let you know what's going on with the whole mask thing. I catch your show like off and on, like probably like 3, 4, or 5 times a month, depending on where my location is.
I appreciate it.
I love your show. So this is what happened to me yesterday. I went to Spokane, made a delivery, and you have to pull your truck into the warehouse. So I pull in, probably 12 people in the warehouse. 6 to 7 of them are not wearing masks. So I get out of my truck, and I go to the pull my left gate down to make the delivery. I have like 7 pallets. And the manager walks up to me and says, you have to put a mask on. I'm telling you that the manager is not wearing a mask.
What?
So I look at him and says, yeah, he's not wearing a mask. So I
But
look
he's
at
telling
him,
you to wear a mask.
He's
Holy
telling
cow.
Me to wear a mask. Yeah, so I look at him and say, no, I'm not putting a mask on. He's like, well, you have to. I'm like, why? Because, well, he says we're following the rules. I'm like, no, you're not. You're telling me I have to put a mask on. Like, you guys are not, like, half you. I pull in here, 6 people are not wearing a mask. You're not wearing a mask. You're telling me I got to put one on. He said, well, we're taking a break.
COVID can infect you during breaks. Didn't you know that, Jeff?
can you make this stuff up?
I can't.
I mean, like, are you freaking serious? So, I love your show, and I have a shout out for the nurses and the teachers. They're going, but I got to tell you, ours, us truck drivers are getting hauled down a very dangerous road.
And you are in very high demand as well. We should not be doing that to any professions. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the program, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. It is First Amendment Friday. Yesterday, I told you about the fact that both the cities of Portland and Seattle, in particular, have seen gigantic increases in violent crime, especially shootings. They tend to get a lot more attention than other violent crime, although I might point out 92% of violent crime in America is not committed with guns at all. That's 92% of the problem. So when you hear politicians say, we're going to solve gun violence, you go, great, you hit 8% of the problem. What are you going to do about the other 92? But yesterday I saw an amazing thing, and I want to get my friend, the former DA Josh Marquis, on to talk about this. As it was touted by the media, which I think was mostly carrying water for the knuckleheads in Portland and Multnomah County, a countywide effort focused on prosecutorial efficiency, removing illegal guns from the community, and investing in community partnerships aimed at prevention of gun violence. And this is the way that they're going to try and do it. By what sounded to me like a lot of kumbaya and giving a lot of money out to activist groups, but not actually going after the criminals who are committing the violent crimes. Josh, what did you make of this whole thing that they rolled out yesterday?
Very much the same, Lars. I hope many of your listeners remember the great writer Tom Wolfe, the one who wrote contemporary novels, and he wrote a short story called "Mau Mauing the Flat Catchers" about radicals in the 70s who would basically white liberals who would give anything essentially to sort of placate gangsters in gang areas of New York City. I'm not sure this is exactly the same, but I watched the news conference. It was horrifying. First off, it was the district attorney, who is technically a state county officer, and the sheriff, who didn't have much to say, who's retiring. And then most loud was Deborah Cafori, who may very well be a candidate for governor, and is, of course, the chair of the Multnomah County Commission. And she got up and talked about, we are going to stop, you know, a stupid lock them up and throw away the key. They are talking with such cognitive dissonance. In other words, they're talking at things counter to each other that make no sense. As you pointed out, violence, shootings, stabbings, people getting hurt has skyrocketed in Portland almost beyond that of almost any other major city in the United States. The response of it has been to not support the police department. The police department has dropped in numbers, both because the cops don't want to work here anymore, and they feel disrespected or even at risk. And the DA's office refused to file cases. And they, you know, they claim they want to fight gun violence, but as you know, they actually killed off the gun violence team because apparently that was too racist a name.
Yeah, because, well, no, Josh, let's be specific about it. They killed off the gun violence reduction team in the police bureau because they were arresting too many people of color. And they said, we can't be arresting people of color. I don't think they cared so much about the name. They said, you can't arrest people of color, and you certainly can't prosecute them. So their solution is to say, we're going to get the guns out of the community, but we're not going to arrest and charge and prosecute and jail the people who are violating the laws. I mean, you catch an ex-felon with a gun, that person should go to jail. Man or woman, black or white, they should go to jail. And that's not happening. So they're going to just go out and take guns away from hoodlums who are going to go get another gun, aren't they?
There's another problem they don't want to talk about. And the victim of this community is overwhelmingly people of color, particularly the black community, which is roughly 8% of Multnomah County, but probably accounts for something like 50% of the victims of gun violence. And I think if you went to most of those gun victims and said, what do you want to have done with the gangbanger of whatever color who drove by your house and scared your 8-year-old, maybe even worse, they would say they want him to go to prison and they want him arrested. So there's this incredible disconnect.
Well, and I point out, Josh, one of the numbers you and I have talked about before, and I want to arm my audience with it, you know, and that is 50% of the homicides in the United States of America are committed by people of color, predominantly black Americans. And 90%,
yeah.
Well, it's just edging up to 50. So, and 90% of their victims are people of color. So if you say Black Lives Matter, then go out and arrest the black Americans who are shooting other, mostly black Americans, and you'll solve 50% of the problem. And I'm not against arresting every criminal who commits a crime with a gun. I want that done. But the reason this just, it's so crazy to say we want to be able to solve the problem of people shooting people. Good. That's a great idea. Who are you going to arrest? Well, we're not going to arrest or prosecute anybody. Why not? Because too many of the people we arrest are people of color. And they come out with this, we're going to give a whole bunch of money, millions of dollars to community groups, which, as you said, it sounds exactly like Bonfire of the Vanities and Tom Wolfe, where you say if we shovel enough money out to the right interest groups, the gangbangers will stop doing illegal things, which I think is a fraudulent idea. It's not. It's not going to happen.
Alternative, the idea is that the some leaders in the community will really lean on the gangbangers to stop it. But you know, we're already seeing.
Has that ever worked? No. Has that ever worked, Josh? Has it ever worked that if the pastors and the other people who are leaders within that community have gone to the gangs and said, "Hey, would you mind not shooting people, or just don't shoot them as much?"
Wait a minute, Lars.
Does that ever work?
No, and let's be clear, in Portland, leaders of the black community have stood up and spoken, and they've said they want more cops and more people with guns. It's basically the white liberals from the Southwest Hills who've decided that they're offended by this.
Who are so not the victims of crime, right?
Exactly. Very rarely.
So when I see them do this and I say, we're going to hire more deputy prosecutors for the DA. You used to run a DA's office until very recently. Do you think that Mike Schmidt, who has touted himself as a social justice warrior, he's a friend of Antifa, he declined to prosecute literally hundreds of violent crimes last year, including assault, including interfering with police officers and attacking police officers, and he said, I'm not going to prosecute these people. Do you think he's not prosecuting homicides because he doesn't have enough staff?
Well, he has enough staff. You can't entirely blame the district attorney for the extreme violence. But at some point, you know, you've got a district attorney who's saying, I don't have the resources for it. It's ridiculous. He's got to take some accountability.
Well, hold on. In any DA's office, Josh, is it fair to say that how many crimes were probably reported to your DA's office in Astoria every year? How many crimes did the cops say there was a crime? 3,000. How many did you prosecute?
Probably 75%, I would guess.
Okay, so 80, but still a few hundred crimes you have to choose. And if shoplifting is a relatively small problem, and you might say, hey, we don't have enough people, we're going to prosecute rapists and people who commit assault and armed robbery and murder instead of prosecuting for vandalism or shoplifting or whatever. That choice has to be made every single time. So the DA's office could say, we don't think it's, in fact, he wants $1 million to go out and hire more people. And he says, now we have to find the money. Just a month ago, he found $500,000 to assign a full-time lawyer and an extraordinary salary of almost $250,000 to go out and unconvict already convicted criminals, right?
Exactly. And I heard the interview of that guy, and it was extraordinary. He doesn't believe he works for the people of Multnomah County. He thinks he still works for the people that are in prison. And he sees his job, apparently, and I'm assuming he must have been told that was his job by Mr. Schmidt. His job is to basically, assist people who are in prison get out of prison.
And with no regard to the people who were the victims of those crimes. That's Josh Marquis, the DA. It's First Amendment Friday. We'll get to your phone calls and your emails coming up next. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show, and we'll talk about tents for lunch at school. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is the Radio Northwest Network, and this segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles. Almost got choked up just thinking about Kate Brown being out of office in a short while. A no showing, no hassles, you pick the closing date. That's nickshivers.com for details. And if you want to answer our Twitter poll today, have Northwest governors created their own health care crisis by forcing out doctors and nurses with vaccine mandates? I'd say yes to that. And we just talked to one of the nurses earlier today who said her last day is the last day of September. And then the unit she used to work in is going to increase the patient-to-nurse ratio, which doesn't sound like a very great idea. I'm not a healthcare expert, that's the way it goes. Let's go to Chris. Hey, Chris, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I'm a longtime listener and huge fan.
Thank you very much.
I have a son named Lars with your funny little name.
Well, tell him he's got a great name. He won't have to worry about people forgetting it.
So he's got the Scandinavian name because of our heritage, but I actually wanted a name that couldn't be lengthened or shortened, and so I named him Lars, but I actually call him Larson.
You do. So, well, tell me what you called about today, please.
So what I'm calling about, I'm from Hood River. So we're from a group called Reds in the Hood, and we are a PAC that we started in 2015, and I'm also actively involved in the GOP, but our group was started to reach out to conservative voters that were not reached through the GOP. So we'll take anybody that's Americans, whether you're Democrats, Republicans, Independents, you know, Hood River is 40% NAV voters. And so we wanted to reach out to those. Yeah. Exactly, non-affiliated voters. And so we started in 2015 when Trump was getting on board and trying to reach those folks across the state and in our county, which we feel is the ticket to winning red in 2022. So, but what I'm calling about is I had an incident that happened out here in Hood River County that I'm trying to get some press on. We had a school board member that actually, in a public testimony, called out white people as the problem. And I can refer you to the recording if you go to Reds in the Hood.
No, let's not do that. Shoot it to me. I'll play it on the air. But, Chris, people driving down the road, people at work aren't able to write all that down. What was the school board member noting about white people as a group?
Well, the work session meeting was about the equity, which is the critical race theory. So they do not call it critical race theory. So if you call your school board member and you complain about CRT or critical race theory, which is kind of more our term rather than their term, they will tell you that they in fact do not teach critical race theory when in fact they do. So the critical race theory that they had in question, they were doing a strategic planning for Hood River County School District for 2021-2022. And the talk was about whether or not they were going to put place, go to sponsor a strategic planning that held this specific CRT, or they call it anti-racism agenda.
Yeah,
so that's what
they
what it
call
was
it.
About. Yeah,
but it is in fact a racist agenda, isn't it, Chris? It's telling white kids you are condemned by your skin color to be seen as an oppressor, and if you're brown or black, then you're viewed as part of the oppressed class, and that's what they're going to teach kids in Hood River County.
Absolutely. So my children, and in this video, she will say that white people are the problem. And my contention, sir, was that I wanted to publicly redress, as did many other people, from our party and from the Reds in the Hood. We wanted to publicly redress this individual for saying that white people are the problem. Because if we in turn stood up and said brown people are the problem, or black people are the problem, or yellow people are the problem, or Japanese are the problem, who in this area, you know, suffered internment camps and everything else, we would be publicly ridiculed and stoned in the courtyard square.
So call her out. What's her name? What's her name?
So her name is Julia Garcia Ramirez. And she is one of seven school board members, the majority of which are liberal, which is fine. Our voters voted those in, but they do not speak for me. And certainly I do not want my white children to believe that their white privileged parents are bad people because they are simply white. We believe in all the great programs that the Hood River County School District and our state provides for everyone to come up through the ranks, whether they are white, black. You know, I came from a white underprivileged class where my parents were economically disadvantaged.
Yep.
And I still rose and went to college. My husband's a physician. Both of us have rose to that level, but we reject that our children are being told that their white privileged parents are the problem.
I would agree with you absolutely, Chris. We're out of time, but I really appreciate your call. And I think that people who are citizens, parents, taxpayers, you ought to file complaints, civil rights complaints, against public officials who choose to speak in the kind of terms that the school board member did in that case. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. Always glad to get your calls as we attempt to serve the Pacific Northwest, as we have for more than 21 years, with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And on Fridays, every subject is fair game. For example, today's Twitter poll: have Northwest governors created their own healthcare crisis by forcing out doctors and nurses with mandates? I just talked to a nurse earlier today on the air who says she basically has about another week on the job and then she's done. Why? Because they're forcing her out with a vaccine mandate. And then Jay Inslee earlier this week went to the White House and said, I need 1,200 healthcare workers right now to meet a crisis that he created himself. So my answer to the question today is going to be yes, but you can answer any way you like. At Lars Larson Show on Twitter, soon to be on Getter one of these days, and also on our website at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I've got a question for you, and it's a bit of a rhetorical question, but it has to do with the environment and the left. Why do people here in the Pacific Northwest who are on the left who say, we want to save the earth, we want to save the environment, why do they ignore the things that weren't their ideas? The man who's made that case is the environmental director with the Washington Policy Center, Todd Myers. Todd, welcome back to the program.
It's always nice to talk with you.
A lot of duplicity on the left. I always say that if Democrats didn't have double standards, they'd have no standards at all. But I wasn't aware that there were clear-cut cases where the left would say, oh, yeah, that might save the planet, but we're not going to do it because it wasn't our idea. Can you fill us in?
Well, there are a number of different examples. And obviously, this week is Climate Week, and there's a lot of work or a lot of attention being made to climate change this week on the left. But many of their policies don't work, and some of the policies that do work, they reject, the most obvious being nuclear power. California is shutting down nuclear power plants. Germany, which had been touted by the left as an example of a model for how to go carbon-free, closed down their nuclear power plants and replaced them with coal. So there's a lot of times when they say, oh, we want to do whatever it takes to fight the climate crisis, but then they have all sorts of things that they aren't willing to do. Another good example is that in Washington State in 2016, we had a proposal for a revenue-neutral carbon tax that would increase taxes on CO2 emissions, but it would cut sales and other taxes. And Governor Inslee, who says he wants to fight climate change, opposed it because it didn't raise taxes. Now, whatever your thoughts about a revenue-neutral carbon tax are, if you're saying it's a climate crisis, and then you say, well, actually, I don't want to take action unless it increases taxes, well, then you care more about taxes than you do about climate, fighting climate change. And I think we see lots of examples of that.
Well, and in fact, I think it's fair to say, Todd, from my point of view, the government is constantly looking for ways to increase taxes, whether it does the citizens any good or not. So they're always looking for an excuse. And usually it's a better excuse if you can tell people why I'm saving the planet. If you object to my to my ideas for higher taxes, then you're objecting to saving the planet. It puts them in a morally superior position, and they get to say, we'd like more taxes, and not just say, we'd like more taxes, and you say, yeah, the government always wants more taxes. Oh, you're doing it to save the planet. Well, that makes it completely different then.
And the way that they get away with this, or at least that they can justify this in their own mind, is that they often ignore the data about what actually works. And so at WashingtonPolicy.org, I just wrote a blog about how the environmental community believes things, but when you look at the data, the opposite is true. So the city of Seattle actually has been called a climate vanguard city by the Clean Cities organization as one of the leaders in the country on taking climate action. But if you look at actually how they're doing in meeting their own CO2 reduction targets, they have missed every single CO2 reduction target they have set, and they are likely to miss the 2020 target that they set. So when you look at the record, they actually are one of the worst in terms of achieving those climate goals, even as the environmental community praises them for being one of the best. And if you care about an issue, you demand accountability. If people aren't delivering on benefits, whether it's the environment or housing or anything else, if you truly care, you will make people accountable when they fail and you reward success. For some reason, on climate change, with the left, which the left says it's the most important issue, the reality is the opposite.
Well, and when you start to reward people, you know, even if the reward is just high praise from some sector they care about, if you reward them for saying you've set the most ambitious goals, therefore we're going to give you laudatory praise, you're really leading people to believe all I have to do is set big goals. I don't have to actually meet them. I just have to set them. And the person who brags the most about what they're going to do gets the prize, and the person who actually accomplishes something may not.
In fact, there is a reward for setting unreasonable goals and doing things that probably don't work. Anyone can do something rational. So you say, okay, I'm going to do this policy and it's going to yield more benefits than costs. Well, anybody can do that. That doesn't send a signal that you care. That's just rational. The only way that you can show that you truly care about fighting climate change is to do something that is ridiculous and risky. And so when we say, look, if you do this, it doesn't make any sense. The answer that we get is, that's how much I care. I'm willing to take this big risk. And we see that again and again. What ends up happening, though, is that instead of doing rational things, we do irrational things because they send very powerful signals. But irrational things don't result in positive results. So we pay more taxes, more for our energy, but we don't actually get the environmental benefits that were promised.
Very well said. That's Todd Myers from the Environmental Director of the Washington Policy Center. Todd, thanks very much. It's First Amendment Friday. Let's go to Ken, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars, how you doing?
Very well.
Good, good. Hey, I just I have concerns roughly around the criminal justice system. So just to tell you a story. So I am a victim of a robbery. My house was robbed back near the end of December of last year.
Yeah.
This system is still going through the court systems. I've had a terrible time with our local police agencies trying to get anything to be done about it. Long story short, two of the guys have ended up back through the court system or into the court system. One of them agreed to basically do a plea bargain for a reduced sentence, I guess you could say, to throw the other guys under the bus. And he did that. And then when I inquired to the DA when these other people were going to be pulled into court and prosecuted, the reason I was given was, oh, we're not going to bring him back into court. We're not going to prosecute him because that guy was not a credible witness because he's a felon. So I'm like, so you made a plea deal with somebody to give testimony knowing good and well that the testimony they provide you're not going to be able to use in court.
So they gave a reward to a criminal and said, we're going to reward, we think you're guilty of something, we're going to give you some time in jail, but at the same time, we don't believe your testimony well enough to be able to use it in another case. That one doesn't make sense. Coming up in a moment, you've heard about those border agents on horseback and the president who's condemning them, even though they're one of his agencies. I want to dig into that in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
You're racist Nazis in Del Rio.
Hey, you're a disgrace.
You're a racist. Nobody wants you in Texas.
Supporting cartels. Supporting cartels is a disgrace.
Why are you not
supporting cartels is a disgrace.
We denounce your racism and your hatred.
You know, that was the reaction that Al Sharpton got when he went down to Texas. And this is the Lars Larson Show. Al Sharpton has been a political opportunist for a long, long time. I think he's still on the hook with the federal government and the IRS because he still owes them piles of money. But he has made millions of dollars over the years going down and exploiting situations like the one he tried to exploit this week at Del Rio, Texas. And you know the background there. That more than 10,000, perhaps as many as 15,000 Haitian refugees came across the border from Mexico into the United States. Now, while the Biden administration has been willing to tolerate over 200,000 illegals coming into our country every single month, 200,000 plus every month, the minute Haitian refugees began coming across the border, and I've had at least a few calls from people saying, why was the Biden administration willing to tolerate brown people illegally entering the United States, but all of a sudden they're intolerant of the idea of black people entering the United States? I don't know that anybody's got a good answer to that. But I will tell you this. What Texas has showed is that both black and brown and white people and every other color and ethnicity in the state of Texas has said to Al Sharpton, you and your racist nonsense are not welcome in our state. They gave him the bum's rush and essentially shouted him down, and he had to leave town. I think he's left town. I don't think he's still down there. So there's a political opportunist for you, and I think a lot of us who've watched Al Sharpton over the years, the guy is almost, well, he is. He is embarrassing in the way that every time something is going on where he can bring up race as an issue, he will show up because there's usually money for Al Sharpton to be made by going down and doing that. But there's a different kind of condemnation that came today from the President of the United States to men and women in uniform who actually work for an agency that answers to the President of the United States, and that is Customs and Border Protection, the Border Patrol agents who are supposed to guard our border. Now, I know it's bizarre to think about it, but we literally have a situation where we have a president who is so in favor of open borders, and he is so much in favor of allowing millions now, millions of people to come into this country illegally. By the end of this year, it will be around 2 million. It has already eclipsed 1 million. He is so in favor of illegal entry to the United States that he's come to the point of condemning people who work for an agency that answers through the Secretary of Homeland Security, right to the President of the United States. It's bizarre. And what's I think maybe even more bizarre is that there's a photo and there is video of Border Patrol agents on horseback. Now, you'd swear that I guess most of the people back in Washington, D.C. have never been around horses. They don't know that maybe they've never ridden a horse. They don't know anything about horses. But they saw these photos, and what they show is border agents on horseback trying to hold back a mob of people illegally entering the United States. Now, Joe Biden doesn't exactly have a friendly point of view toward these people. He's taking some of them, at least, loading them on airplanes and flying them right back to Haiti where they started. Others, I think, he's allowing to come into the United States. They claim that they have deported a couple of thousand Haitians, but they also claim they've cleared out that bridge in Del Rio, Texas, where there are about 15,000 of them. So the math doesn't work. The Biden administration is letting these people go. But in the meantime, Joe Biden and most of the news media have taken these pictures of the border agents on horseback. And part of their regular training is that if you're on horseback, the last thing you want to do is let somebody in the crowd that you're trying to control, police agencies around America. I've done plenty of stories on horse patrols. They're very effective for crowd control, but you cannot allow somebody in that crowd to take control of the horse. So they say part of their regular training is to use the reins, not a whip, the reins, you know, the leather straps, okay, to ward people away. So if they get too close to that horse, they may be able to grab a hold of the rider, grab a hold of the horse, take control of the horse, maybe even take the horse away from the border agent. So the border agents are told how to stop that from happening. Now, in all those photos and in all that video, there isn't a single one where any of these illegal aliens get hit by one of the rains. But it very quickly became a cause célèbre because the media said, my God, there's a border agent on horseback and he's whipping illegal aliens. And in fact, we even heard Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland Security, say, why, this harkens back to, and he used some complicated words. I may run the soundbite in a moment, but he talks about how this harkens back to slavery. In no way, shape, or form is this a slave master whipping somebody. This is a man on horseback who's a law enforcement officer who can't afford to let somebody in a mob of illegal aliens get control of his horse and perhaps even knock him off that horse. And yet, what does Joe Biden do? In the same breath, and I'm going to play the soundbite, in the same breath where he says, we really need to investigate and find out what happened here, he also, at the same time, goes ahead and condemns his own Border Patrol agents for doing their jobs, as though the president's already decided they're guilty. Oh, yeah, sentence first, trial later. Take a listen to what Joe Biden had to say about his own Border Patrol. Listen to this.
Of course, I take responsibility. I'm president, but it was horrible what to see, as you saw. To see people treated like they did, horses barely running them over, people being strapped, it's outrageous. I promise you, those people will pay. They will be, an investigation underway now, and there will be consequences. There will be consequences. It's an embarrassment, but it's beyond an embarrassment. It's dangerous. It's wrong. It sends the wrong message around the world. It sends the wrong message at home. It's simply not who we are.
Now, hold on a second. Joe Biden himself, you just heard the soundbite. He said people were run over by horses. Nobody was run over by a horse. Nobody. There were people who tried to go get too close to the horses, and they were pushed back. Not one of them was hit with the end of the reins. Not one of them got run over by the horses. And as Joe Biden says, that they were strapped, meaning they were whipped by his border agents. The president has already found them guilty and decided that these border agents are guilty, but then in the same breath says, well, they're guilty. What they did was wrong, but I'm not going to actually, I'll let it be investigated first, but he's already decided they're guilty of what they're accused of. Take a listen to Secretary Mayorkas, who talks about the horses and the reins. And again, he doesn't understand either. Listen to this.
The images horrified us in terms of what they suggest and what they conjure up in terms of not only our nation's history, but unfortunately the fact that that page of history has not been turned entirely. And that means that there is much work to do, and we are very focused on doing it.
Now, what Mayorkas is referring to, that page of history, he's referring to slavery. It's very clear from the context of his comments that he's effectively saying, why, these are like slave masters on horseback whipping these poor illegal aliens. Nobody got whipped. There isn't a single photo for all the photos and video, not a single one of anybody being hit, and they weren't being whipped. They were being warded away so they would not take over the horse and the rider and illegally enter our country. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails, too. You know, a lot of us have worried that there are so many distractions going on right now, the distractions of Afghanistan, the distractions of the border, of COVID, of mask mandates and everything else, that you may not be paying enough attention to what's going on Capitol Hill, as the Democrats keep pushing an infrastructure plan that is virtually guaranteed to make your utility bill skyrocket. Steve Malloy is a former member of Donald Trump's EPA transition team and the founder of JunkScience.com. Steve, welcome back, and would you mind describing for the people listening what exactly the Democrats have in mind? It's not just going to cost them money out of the federal treasury.
Yeah, hey, Lars, thanks for having me. So, there is this infrastructure bill out there, and it does have, you know, it's the bipartisan infrastructure bill. It's got a little bit of climate in it, but the big one that we need to worry about is this, you know, $3.5 trillion, or what is it, $5.5 trillion dollar bill. Trillion bill that has all the climate stuff in it. And one of the provisions is this thing called the Clean Electricity Performance Program, which is essentially federalization of the electricity grid. And if you liked what happened in Afghanistan, what's going down at the border, who wouldn't want the federal government in charge of our electricity grid? And so they have developed this sort of Rube Goldberg-esque plan for both paying and penalizing utilities to force them into solar and wind, which, of course, is a disaster, as is being proved right now in Europe.
You know, Steve, I've done a lot of reading, even on the pro-solar crowd, and I'm not against solar as a technology. I just say it's got to pencil out. But there are people like one of them is Axion Power that says, yeah, we could power the whole world with solar. The only problem is when you actually do the math and say, how much space is that going to take? They say, well, it'd probably take for the world, 51 billion solar panels or 115 square miles of planet Earth. You can also do the numbers for America. And even using the pro-solar crowd's numbers, you say, you're talking about, you know, tens of millions of acres of a country covered with solar panels, most of them bought in China, which doesn't seem like a great thing to become dependent on China for, since we seem to be dependent on them for far too much. This is what they're pushing toward, isn't it?
Yeah, and then what do you do when the sun goes down? Well, then you've got to turn on your gas plants. So you have to have the gas plants anyway. And so all you've done is really just have this extra solar cost. You know, the solar panels, they're not cheap. I mean, the only reason they're cheap because they're made by slave labor in China. You know, if they were made in the United States, they wouldn't be so cheap anymore. And, of course, that's why they're not made in the United States, or very, very few of them are made here. But, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, you're afraid it pencil out. It doesn't pencil out. In Europe right now, they are going through an energy crisis. They are praying that the winter is not too cold because earlier in the year, the wind failed. And because the wind has failed this year, they've had to rely on more natural gas. And, of course, they got rid of the coal option, and now they're dependent on Vladimir Putin for natural gas. And the whole thing is just a disaster. And in the U.K. right now, you know, they're shutting down factories. They're figuring out how they're going to ration electricity. I mean, it is just a disaster.
Well, and what happens? I mean, I want people to imagine what's going on there is going to be modeled here, even though Europe seems to have realized to some extent, even Germany has realized this was a bad way to go, that when you're told, sorry, by the way, your power bill is going up, and because your power bill went up and we can't produce enough electricity, we have to turn it off to these industries. So you say, great, so I still have electricity at my house, maybe, but my job has gone away either temporarily or, you know, or for a long time. What good does that do anybody? And I know the libs will find some way to say, well, it's somebody else. It's evil capitalists or something. But you say we're a country that has an abundance of energy and almost every form of it, including the nat gas plants you just mentioned to produce electricity. That's all been rejected by the Greens as well.
Yeah. I mean, let's just say you were a responsible politician faced with these choices. You know, you would say, okay, well, we want to get off fossil fuels. We want to move into new technology. So let's do it when that technology is ready. Instead, Democrats want on Monday to basically railroad the country for the, you know, rest of the century in terms of, you know, they want to tell us what kind of energy we should have when, you know, wind and solar, they're really just, they're not ready for prime time. It's not that anybody opposes any of this stuff. But I do value electricity, and so does everybody else. We need to have it. We cannot go into blackout like California has recently, you know, rolling blackouts. And when the wind failed in Texas in February, you know, the grid went down. We cannot afford to have that. Our lives depend on electricity and gasoline. Those are the two things we can't do without right now. When there's technology that can replace how we generate electricity, and when there's a technology that, you know, gets us away from gasoline. If people want to do that, okay. But that we're just not there yet.
Well, and Steve, is part of this persuading people? I mean, the most recent example I saw where I found that once something starts to actually hit people personally, I've talked about taxes before, and I'll talk them till I'm blue in the face. And then a year and a half later, when the tax actually hits, I get calls from people going, who said yes to this tax? And I say, well, we talked about that a year and a half ago. Yeah, but that was just theoretical at that time. No, I was telling you it was being passed. So my most recent example, and you're aware of this because of junkscience.com, there are literally computers that are illegal to buy in certain parts of the United States because they said, oh, that computer, yeah, that one chews up too much power. So we aren't going to let you buy that one. And I don't know if Americans are aware of it. They're already doing this with home appliances, saying, That washing machine that works so well, no, you can't buy one like that anymore. You want to replace the old one, you better repair the old one because they don't make them like that. And it applies to every electric consuming appliance in your house. And you say, you mean the government is going to tell me what kind of washing machine, dishwasher, anything that uses water can use? Yep. And they're already doing it. Oh, well, I wasn't aware of that. It's blissful ignorance.
Yeah, one of the reasons we have, you know, our appliances are so expensive and cars are so expensive is because the government has heaped in all these green regulations that have made things more expensive. And, of course, you know, the manufacturers are more than happy to have these regulations because it means they get to, pass on the costs with a little bit extra margin for them. But all these things do have a cost. Nothing is for free. When you ask people, how much would you actually spend on climate? You find out it's very little, and this is really doesn't matter who does the poll. The Washington Post, very left leaning newspaper, and the Competitive Enterprise Institute, they both done polls showing that people do not want to spend money on climate. But that is not how it is being positioned. It's being positioned as the planet is going to be destroyed in 10 years unless we start cutting emissions now. And, people don't really understand the whole issue, so they just, a lot of them just go along with it.
Well, and Steve, I mean, you made the point about a little extra margin. But imagine this. Almost everything else that's manufactured has become cheaper over the last several decades. You know, you can buy all kinds of electronics cheaper. But if you walk in and you say, how come a washing machine used to cost $400 and now it costs $800? And as you said, the manufacturer doesn't care. Actually, they've got a built-in incentive. If the manufacturer says, we usually make a 10% profit when we sell a washing machine. So you sell a $400 washing machine, you make $40. You sell an $800 washing machine, you make $80. Yeah. Which one do you think? And the rest of the cost goes right to the consumer. Which one do you think they want to deliver?
No, that's right. And this week, the Biden administration finalized some rules on new air conditioning chemicals, which is going to make air conditioning and refrigeration cost more. And, of course, the industries don't care. As a matter of fact, they lobby for it.
because they're going
to. Because it means more money for them.
They're going to lobby all the way to the bank. That's Steve Malloy. You can find his work at junkscience.com. And yes, he was a member of the Trump transition team at the EPA. I wish he was still there. We'll be back in just a moment. It's First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. That's right. They do at 866-HEY-LARS on the Radio Northwest Network. Our Twitter poll today, have Northwest governors created their own health care crisis by forcing out the very doctors and nurses they need with those vaccine mandates? I'd say yes to that. You're free to vote any way you like. There's actually choice still there, even though the government seems to be interested in taking away choice everywhere else. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Oregon Catalyst, which is a product of the Taxpayers Association, points out the Portland public schools are now buying $300,000 worth of tents. And you might wonder, why are they buying tents? They're the big tents that you'd have if you're going to have, an outdoor wedding or an outdoor event during inclement times of the year. The public schools are buying these gigantic tents to use at lunchtime so kids can go outdoors for lunch. The problem is, here in the Pacific Northwest, how long are you going to be able to use those tents at this point in the year? Maybe into October a bit. I'll bet by November, it's going to be a pretty uncomfortable place to be eating lunch. December, absolutely. January, February, March, not so good. And then maybe get a little bit of use in April and May. And that's about it. $300,000 for tents to tell kids to socially distance. If that makes sense to anybody, let me know. This hour of the this segment of the show is brought to you by Marquee Hot Tubs. They'll give you the ultimate hot tub and swim spa experience. Just visit online or go to one of their physical locations. That's Marquis, MarqueeHotTubs.com. Let's go to Kennewick, where they listen to Great Talk Radio on KONA. Hey, Ricky, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you very much, Lars. See, I've purchased a large caliber rifle, and I'm having difficulty finding rounds for it. I've gone to 8 different websites nationally here, but as well, I can't even find brass if I choose to start reloading. I have the dies for it,
It's supply and demand.
What's your insight? I've talked about it before
because Ricky, I run into the same problem. I don't have any. Well, look, I have a gun store I patronize, but I go by their rules. They've limited their sales to each customer so that they don't make every customer. Well, they can make one customer very happy by saying, buy all you want, and then every other customer they have would be unhappy. It's largely supply and demand. And Ricky, I've talked about the numbers before. In the last year or so, we've probably seen more than 10 million newbies who've come in and said, I've never owned a gun before, I want to own a gun. A lot of them, surprisingly enough, are liberals. And there's been a gigantic jump in the number of women and people of color who are buying guns for the very first time. And even if they just buy a couple of boxes, all of a sudden that, coupled with regular demand, coupled with people's fear of not being able to get enough ammunition, it's just simply run all the ammo companies. I mean, there's one company called Hornady. I've got no special connection. I buy some Hornady rounds. They've said that everything they are going to make over the next 2 years is already spoken for. So their entire output, and that describes most of the ammo makers. So they're out of luck.
All I want is like 20 rounds so I can go elk hunting or knock down a moose in Spokane before it jumps in front of a school bus, for crying out loud.
Now, see, I love your thinking that I'd love to go knock down a moose too. I've never taken a moose. I didn't get to go hunting this year. I was going to go bow hunting this year with my friend Alfredo. Just could not get the time to go do it. But even when I was rifle hunting, well, you know, I tended to have years, Ricky, where I would joke with my friends that I'm the reason they make rounds, 20-round boxes, because I'd use a lot. You know, and oftentimes all I'd get was coyotes. And then there are other years where I'd go out with a 20-round box and I'd come back with 19 rounds. I mean, I'd get lucky one year. And so I have some left over. But the fact is, it's supply and demand. And believe me, the ammo makers would love to be producing more, but they just don't have the factory facility. And it's very expensive to expand those factories. And then what do you do if you spend, I think one of the new factories I heard about that opened right before the pandemic was $50 million they had to spend on that plant, and it took them 18 months to build it. So imagine putting $50 million in, knowing it's going to take you a long time to earn it back. And then what happens when demand is satisfied and all of a sudden supply or, you know, sales drop off hard and you're stuck with this plant to make something that's no longer in high demand? That's the tough thing. And I wish I had a special place for you to go to. Let's go to Todd. Hey, Todd, thanks for listening on First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Lars, I've listened to you since you were on the TV here in Portland, and this is my first time to call you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I wanted to let you know about the incident with the illegal alien and the horse down on the border. I was raised on a quarter horse and Polled Hereford Ranch in Texas. That cowboy was using what's called a split rein bridle.
Yep.
And the only thing that happened is the right hand rein fell down. That's all that happened.
Well, I will tell you this, Todd. The border agents, if Joe Biden bothered to listen to the people in his own agencies, they'd say this is part of our protocol, that if you're trying to manage a crowd and you have the reins in your hand and you can ward people off, nobody was actually hit by that leather. But if you ward them off to keep them at a distance, because what they've told these agents in training is if you let somebody get too close to you and they get a hold of you or the horse, and they either take control of the horse or they pull the rider off the horse, then you got an even bigger problem. So they do use the reins to try to get people to stand back. And frankly, I wish the illegal aliens would follow the law.